I don't know if you realize it, Mr. Correll. I've thought of this several times, that you're in a very unique position, you and your partner, because, like Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin, they belong to a medium, that is no longer in existence, and you belong to what they call the golden age of radio, which can never be revived, and so no one can ever top you. You were the king.
Well, we were very fortunate in getting started when radio was kind of a baby in its crawling stage, you know, and we happened to hit on something that the people liked very much, and they were very loyal to us and stuck with us, and we worked a little hard at it, of course, like you have to do with anything. But we were very, very fortunate to have people stay with us as long as they did. And you're right. We stayed with us until we were the last, I think, show to leave the air outside of news broadcasts, you know, and disc jockey shows. And the fact of the matter was our last show was a kind of a glorified disc jockey show.
I remember I worked at CBS at the time, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
In fact, I knew a man named Jack Daly, I think, who worked on your show.
Yeah,
young
sure,
fellow.
That's
nice
right,
man.
Sure,
very nice
sure,
to
I remember him, certainly. Yes, sir.
You used to even do interviews, I think, on it.
Yeah, we had several of the actors around town come on it, and it worked out pretty well. But, I don't know, I guess it got like all of the entertaining shows in the daytime. People weren't listening to them as long as television was going. Television is what they would rather look at than radio. They couldn't see radio, but they could work, though, while radio was going on. You can't do much work with television going on. You have to watch it.
What made you switch from the title Sam and Henry to Amos Nandy?
Well, that was on the count of... we started the Sam and Henry on a station in Chicago, the Chicago Tribune station, WGN, in 1926. And they took out a patent on the thing, you see. They had a syndicate department, and they own everything that's in their syndicate department. You know, like Andy Gump and all of their comic strips. They owned them themselves. So they took out a patent on it, and we had some ideas of wanting to expand a little bit, and they didn't want us to do some of the things we wanted to do. We wanted to get up a network of our own and sell Sam and Henry to stations around the country or around that section that the WGN covered. Well, they weren't for that too much, so our contract was about to run out, and we left them and got patent, or rather a copyright, on the show ourselves, and gave it the name of Amos and Andy, and started our own network, and we did. We had a network of 60 or 70 stations just before we went on NBC.
You had done Sam and Henry in vaudeville, though, had you not?
No. We never played vaudeville at all. We were used to put on amateur shows around the United States from 1917, and then my partner joined the company in 1919, and when he joined, we worked together from then on, which, incidentally, is exactly 50 years ago now.
How did you happen to meet him, Freeman Gosling?
Well, he came to work for the same company that I was working for, putting on a show. I was rehearsing a show, amateur shows these were, you see. We used people in town. We put them on for the Elks or the American Legion or the Shrine, Kiwanis Club, Knights of Columbus, and organizations like that that had a lot of members, you know.
Was it all the same town or you traveled?
No, we traveled all over the United States.
Uh-huh.
And I was in Durham, North Carolina, putting on a show. Now, we never let anybody come in the room where I was rehearsing except those who were in the show, so their attention wouldn't be distracted. So the door opened, this fellow walked in, and I was sitting by him, a saloon piano player. I was sitting playing the piano, and I stopped, and I turned around and looked at him. I says, "Can I do something for you?" And he says, "Is your name Charlie Correll?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "I'm Freeman Gosling." I said, "Oh, yeah, I had a letter about you from our company saying you're coming down here to get the music and the scripts and a little bit of instruction on the show, and then go on down to a little town, Elizabeth City, North Carolina, to put on a show there himself." And that was the beginning of our getting together and our working together, and we have been together ever since.
For 50 years.
The greatest day that ever happened to me in my life. Him to walk in and say, "I'm Freeman Gosling." So there you are.
Well, were your characters a hit right away?
Yes, they were. They seemed to be pretty much of a hit. And, of course, you know, we started Sam and Henry. We didn't want any part of it until we found out whether it was going to go or not, because we didn't want to be connected with any fluff. And for some time, the people, even around WGN, didn't know who was doing Sam and Henry. We would do it in a hotel room, the station, the studio, WGN studio, one big room on the 10th floor of the Drake Hotel was there, and we'd do it from another room, and nobody knew who was doing it. And we would write all the stuff, too, that we did until we got on our half-hour show, and then we had to get writers, because that's quite a deal, getting a half-hour, getting a full, complete story once a week. To pull a story out of the air is a big deal, once a week, you know. But on our daily show, we just wrote from day to day.
Were the characters Sam and Henry essentially what they were when you transferred to Amos and Andy?
The voices were the same, of course, but we changed the whole story and the whole scene from... we had an express company, and we changed it to a taxicab company, and the lodge we had, and everything we had, we changed it around, but the voices were practically the same because these two voices were ours, and there's nothing you could do about that.
You were Andy?
Yes.
So what other voices did you do?
Well, I did Andy, and things that we kept alive, Henry Van Porter, who was the society, the big society man.
You had trouble with his wife,
right? No, that was Brother Crawford.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, my partner did that. Yeah. My partner did all the high voices, which was Amos, Brother Crawford, and Lightning. And then he did the Kingfish, because that was a low voice. The Kingfish and Andy are very, very close together. My partner's voice and mine normally are almost identical. In fact, when we used to, in our office, if one of our wives would call up, either one of the other, one or the other would answer, the wives wouldn't know which one it was. That's how close our voices were together. So he did the Kingfish, which was a low voice, and I did Andy, and then I did some higher voice. You see, Henry Van Porter was a higher voice, and I did a thing called The Landlord that we kept alive. We did many other voices, but they weren't kept alive, and it didn't make much difference.
What about Miss Blue?
Well, Miss Blue was done by a girl.
That was Andy's secretary.
Yeah. We put girls to work when we got Madam Queen in the thing.
She's my favorite character of all time.
Miss Lou?
Yeah. No, I met Madam Queen. I remember particularly when the libel suit, or the breach of promise suit.
Yeah,
when Andy refused to marry her.
we're going to try to do this voice ourselves, and did do one word Madam Queen said. I think Prima did that. I think my partner did that. But it was, you know, it wasn't right, and we knew it, and we couldn't do it. If we're going to have a woman in there, we better get a woman. Or we're dead. As soon as we started to do women's voices, that would have killed us off quick. So that's when we started to do women. We got the Kingfish's wife. We got the Madam Queen. Then if we needed women for anything, we got women. So there wouldn't be any doubt about voices.
Did you get a woman for Arbidella, Amos's
little girl? Yes, Arbidella in the beginning was a Chinese girl. A little Chinese girl, very sweet character, and a very good little actress. And then later, when the television show came out, of course, then they got a little Negro girl.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have an audience for your radio show?
Not for our daily shows. We didn't allow anybody in the studio, including our wives. I don't know why, but I think it was because we were trying to do what we thought people might laugh at, whether it was funny or not. It might have been situations, which it was most of the time. And they would sit in the studio knowing that they couldn't laugh out loud. In those days, you had to be so quiet. If a pin dropped in there, ruined the whole show. Anybody call for something, they'd shoot you. But anyhow, we didn't let anyone come into the studio until we did our half-hour show. Then we began to get an audience. And then, of course, if they didn't jam the thing full, we were disappointed. We were hoping it'd jam it full. And they did. We always had good audiences, very good.
When did you move from Chicago to New York?
We never did move permanently to New York. We worked out of New York many times, and we used to make appearances in theaters, and we would center in New York and center in Detroit for a little while, or in Philadelphia or something. However, wherever was the closest to where we were working. But we never did move to New York as a home.
I can remember going to down the main avenue in Detroit, which is where I lived, and seeing on the few theater marquees that we had in the neighborhood, Amos and Andy tonight from 7 to 7:15. And they would take the feature film off and then put it on again after Amos and Andy.
Well, that was a very, very flattering thing. And when we first heard about it, we were a little upset because we thought they were stealing or using us to draw people into the theater. Well, the fact of the matter is they weren't. They told us later, which was very, very flattering, that people wouldn't come until our show was over. So they put us up on the marquee out in front. Listen to Amos and Andy here at 7 to 7:15. And they would stop the picture, turn up the lights, and turn on the radio for 15 minutes, then go back to the picture, which is the craziest thing anybody ever heard of. But it was very, very flattering.
I suppose you know this, that Amos and Andy was also piped in some of the department stores when they were open nights.
No, that I didn't hear. I never knew that. I didn't hear about that.
Well, I can't think of the one in Detroit, but I remember going to it when I was a little boy, and it was piped in.
Well, I would imagine if the theaters were doing it, some of the stores would be doing it, too, just for the fun of it, you know.
You know, this one of the great trivia questions is, which no one seems to be able to answer, I think I know, but let me ask you, who was your competition? No one ever thinks that anyone would put up anybody against Amos and Andy.
Oh, sure, we had competition along the line. We didn't have competition in the same type of show. Now, we had, at the time, early in the game, there was a team on called Merton March.
Yeah, I heard from Myrtle Vale quite recently.
Did you?
She's in Chicago.
I said hello to her when I was in Chicago. I was in Chicago on the radio.
She's 80.
And yep.
Looks great.
Listening. She was listening to the show. I had an interview with a fellow at WGN. Funny part of it is that I didn't know it was on the air. I thought he was taping the thing, was going to put it on later. And I said, well, when is this going to be shown? He says, played. I said, what do you mean played? He says, we just got off the air. And I pretty near fell down because I would have been a little more, not afraid, but tense, maybe. And so I said hello to her then. So they were against us at one time.
They'd have been on CBS.
That's right.
Right.
And then, of course, there were teams like Lum and Abner, who were very good. They did a very similar thing to ours, only in rural, mm-hmm. You know, farmer, rural thing. And that's about all. We had the only competition we ever were a little bit afraid of was Moran and Mack, the two Black Crows. They came on at one time, but they made a mistake of doing everything on records before they put it on the air, so everybody knew what they were going to say.
Hmm.
So we soon got away from being afraid of them.
I remember their names, but I don't remember hearing them. They mustn't have lasted.
Yeah, the two Black Crows. They were on for Majestic Radio.
Did you know many of the big names of radio at the time?
Oh, yeah, we knew pretty near everybody, and also a lot of stage names. We got better acquainted with the stage names later, of course, because radio, everybody on stage, like Jack Benny and Fanny Bryce and George Jessel, and a lot of those old-time names used to think that people on radio were crazy, you know? And we thought so, too. Well, we thought every year would be our last year. We went for 32 years on the network and thought every one of them would be our last one.
You were so popular. How was it you would think that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what...
The bubble would burst? And...
Yes, because you'd say to yourself all the time, well, this can't go every day for another year. You know, for 16 years, we did a daily show. Then for 16 more years, we did a weekly show.
Mm-hmm. The one I was going to ask you about, if you knew, I think he's dead now, was Singing Sam the Barbasol Man.
Yeah, I knew him. I had him in an amateur show one time in Richmond, Indiana. That's his home.
Where's your home?
Peoria, Illinois.
What about Mr. Gosden?
His is Richmond, Virginia, his original home.
You're still very close?
Oh, sure.
What's he doing these days?
Nothing. He spends a lot of time in Palm Springs, especially in the winter. And I saw him just the day before yesterday. We were talking to each other. We were both of us in the same place at lunch with different people. We weren't together for lunch, but we talked to each other for a little while. I talked to him more on the phone than I do personally, but we get together every now and then, someplace, or we meet each other on the street down in Beverly Hills.
You live in the Truesdale Estates in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Where does he live?
He lives down in Beverly Hills proper. He lives down on one of the streets there, right below Sunset Boulevard. In a very, very nice little house. Very, very nice house.
Did you always think up your own characters?
Yes, we did. And we tried to make our characters a cross-section of life. Like, most of the characters. Everybody knows a fellow like the Kingfish, just living on his wits. Everybody knew an Andy, who is a lazy type of a fellow that'll do anything anybody wants him to do if they'll pay him something for it. Nobody knew an Amos because we made him such a nice fellow, he almost walked on water. We made him so nice, we got him out of the show. It got to the point where we could hardly use him because everybody knew that if Amos was to walk into a scene that Andy and the Kingfish were doing in some kind of conniving thing or trying to get together on some kind of a daffy business or something. They knew that Amos would just have to come in and say, listen, you two fellas are off your beam. You ought to cut this out. You're crazy. It can't be done. And that'll be the end of the scene.
Yeah, he was a very, very decent human being. I remember particularly at Christmas time, your Christmas show. That was the only time, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Andy worked. He used to work as a Santa Claus.
Oh, yeah, he went to work as a Santa Claus.
To buy Arvidella toys.
Yeah, to buy her a talking doll. I know, yeah, that's what he wanted to get her. And I have that film here. It was done by our television show, too. And I have the film, yes, here. And I look at it every now and then. It's a very, very nice job they did on that thing. And it's a very touching little thing, you know, about the guy wanting to work. He didn't have a quarter to get this friend's daughter a doll.
I didn't see the television version of the Christmas show, but I remember it so well on radio because I used to do it annually. It was a traditional thing.
Yeah, we did that one thing quite a good many years, the Christmas show.
As I recall, it ended with Amos sitting by Arbidella's bed reciting the Lord's Prayer.
That's right, explaining the Lord's Prayer.
That's right, explaining.
He explained to her what it meant. And they made records of that later, and I still think they're on the market. I don't know. At Christmas time,
that had great charm.
Yeah, that was a pretty well-done thing. We had nothing to do with the writing of that. We got a fellow to write it for us who was a very neutral fellow. He had a church in Chicago called the People's Church. And before we got into it, we talked to everybody, you know, Protestants, Catholics, Jews, the whole business, so that we didn't offend or try to offend anybody, and got the best thing we could get from each one of these people and had them listen. They all endorsed it, said that's nothing in here to make anybody mad.
I know you don't want to work anymore, but do you ever sort of miss it? You did it for so long every day.
I don't miss it. Well, I'll tell you, it's a chore. We broadcast twice a day, every day, and you live by a watch, you know. And gee whiz, you can't get farther away from a studio than you can walk back to it.
Now, young people don't understand why you broadcast twice a day. Would you explain
that? Well,
that
was for the change of time. You see, we broadcast in New York, one broadcast, 7 o'clock in New York. Then we broadcast at 10 in Chicago. We lived in Chicago and emanated from Chicago most of the time until we moved out here. And 10 o'clock there, 9 Mountain, 8 Pacific. And that was the reason for the two broadcasts. So if we'd have done it on the 7 o'clock thing in New York, it'd be too early out here. A little too early. 7, 6, 5, it'd be 4 o'clock on the West Coast. And this isn't a good time for sponsors.
Speaking of sponsors, the one I remember most is Pepsodent. How many years did you have
that? That was our first one. 8.5 years was Pepsodent. That was our first sponsor. Then we went to Camel Soup for another 8 years. Then we went to Lever Brothers on their rental program, and then we went to Rexall Drug Company for 5 or 6 years, and then into the Radio City, Amos and Andy Music Hall, which was a lot of sponsors, you know, 5 or 6 different sponsors.
That was after you switched from NBC to CBS.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you see many people from the old days?
Oh, sure. I see. Every time I go to Chicago, I have lunch with some of the gang from the old WGN studios. I always stay at the Drake Hotel, where we started in 1925, for money. We started 2 years before that for nothing. Got no pay for a couple of years, and then we went to work at WGN singing songs. And that was in 1925. So I always go back to Drake for nostalgic reasons, for one thing, and not only that, it's a good place to go, in my estimation, so that's that.
Where'd you get the idea for the Mystic Knights of the Sea Lodge?
Well, I don't know. We made it a fish thing. In the Simon Henry days, we had a lodge called the Jewels of the Crown. It was the most precious diamond was the head of it, and they were all named after jewels. So we had to get something we thought was a little like that. And after a little while of thinking and throwing in and throwing out and putting in different things, we came up with this crazy fish thing where it was the Mystic Knights of the Sea, where all the officers were big fish, like the kingfish and the whale and so and so. And the members were all sardines.
did you have much to do with the television version?
Only not too much, except to show them in the beginning, until our director kind of got a hold of it, and then we let it alone, because the people that were doing it were a little, they wouldn't be themselves when we were on the set. You see, they were, like I would be, too. If I was trying to do a Red Skelton or somebody, I would be embarrassed to pieces if he was sitting there listening to me. But if he wasn't there, I might try to do it, you know, if I was an impersonator. So they were trying to do these characters as best they could. And if we came on the set, they naturally became a little bit embarrassed. And they would tighten up, and they wouldn't be natural or normal. So once our director found out what the characters would and wouldn't and should and shouldn't do, we didn't have to go back anymore.
Were you happy, pretty happy with the way it was done on TV?
Yeah, pretty happy. Not completely happy, but pretty happy, because to imitate the voices and look anything like what we thought they ought to look like was quite a thing. And their voices were so close to ours that visually you would accept them as the voices that we did. But, of course, if they were to do it on radio and you were listening, you'd say, oh, no, that's not Amos and Andy, you see. But visually, you would accept them. They were very, very good.
Do you think the public always knew that you were white people doing these characters?
I don't know about that. In the beginning, I know darn well they didn't. No. In the beginning, they didn't know whether we were white or colored. And an awful lot of people, even the colored people, thought we were colored. And of course, we happen to know Southern dialect. There's no such thing as colored dialect. I don't know if anybody ever told you that or stopped to think of it, but there isn't. The colored people, all of them that have any big dialect, started getting it from Southerners. There are 400 different dialects in the South. I can't understand some of them myself. My partner, for example, gee whiz, he came from Virginia, and they had a dialect down there that was really thick. Holy smoke. If he wanted to say, for example, if he wanted to say the score on the scoreboard is 14-4, he'd say the score on the scoreboard is 14-4. Now, you don't know what he said. Now, I used to say to him, you're going to have to pronounce R's. You're going to go up north. These people don't know what you're talking about.
What is your favorite character?
My favorite character, I think, was the Kingfish. He was a great character. What a character. Heaven's sake. As I say, everybody knows the Kingfish. I know a lot of them right now. I was talking to one very dear friend of mine today. I won't mention his name or what he does. But my gosh, this guy is always in a promotion thing. He's always doing a promotion thing. And I don't know whether any of it ever gets done or not, but he's got it, and he's got it down on paper and everything. He's running around promoting this or that and the other thing, and I don't think he ever promotes anything.
I began by giving you a great compliment, but I was going to say, too, I cannot think of any comedy on or any program on radio or television since or movies before that ever had the impact Amos and Andy had.
Well,
it had a terrific influence on America.
In the beginning, you know, as I say, we happened to hit something, and it was entirely different. Daily, nobody's ever done the Daily Show. We've got a lot of firsts to our credit. And don't misunderstand me. I'm not bragging. I told you in the beginning we were very, very lucky, very fortunate to have all these things happen to us. That would never happen again, I don't think. I know it wouldn't happen. Once in a while, you get a hold of a show that people run to listen to for maybe a month or something, and then they quit. But they stuck with us for 32 years. That is a long time. And I think, egotistically, that if we were to go back on the air tomorrow, they'd stick with us again.
But, yes, it was a terrific loyalty for Amos and Andy. It was a way of life. I mean, something that everyone did every 5 days a week. It was like eating and...
We had a loyal audience that I'll tell you we will forever be grateful to.
You still hear from fans?
Yes, every now and then. And we especially hear if one of us that gets... I was sick here, not sick. I had water on both knees. I twisted my knees doing some Christmas decorating. And all of a sudden, a week or so later, it began to hurt, and I had to go to the hospital with water on both knees. Well, gee whiz, it got in the paper, and you should see the letters and the cards that I got from people that I didn't know who they were all over the United States. It got out in the paper, you know, and probably was on the air or something. And I got the most wonderful bunch of cards and letters, and I got some news for you. I answered every single one of them.
You probably get some more now after you say that.
Well, I start to be a pen pal.
Of course, you're in a particularly unusual situation. I mean, most radio people were not recognized on sight, and then your names were not as well known as the characters.
No, that's right. That's right.
And I don't think you even particularly publicized your names, Charles Correll and Freeman Gosden, did
you? Not too much, no. And I had a funny thing happen to me the other day. I was down in San Diego, and I had made reservations on the airlines, on one of the airlines, to come back here. I'd been down visiting our daughter. It was our grandson's birthday, so we went down there to visit him and my daughter. So I had made reservations. We drove down in our car, and my son went with us, and he drove the car back. And we were going to fly home, and a man came in, a friend of ours, so we came back with him. But to make a long story short, I called up the airline and told him I wanted to cancel my reservation. I said, I made reservations, but I said a friend of mine has come in with his car, so we decided to go back with him. He said, what's your name? And I said, Correll. And he said, okay, Mr. Correll, he said, you say? Yeah, he says, would that happen to be Correll and Gosden? I said, that's right. Now, here's a fellow, and a young fellow. I knew he was a young fellow, and the younger generation, of course, weren't our fans. Their fathers and mothers were now. But I had several young people. Had a fellow call me from Kentucky the other day, a university down there, and wanted to know if I'd interview him on the phone, and I did. He said, well, you know, I'm an old-timer, too. He said, I'm one of those old-timers. I said, yeah, I said, how old are you? He said, I'm 29. And for heaven's sake, an old-timer. I'm old enough to be his great-grandfather.
Well, I think there's a warm spot in the hearts of a lot of people for Amos and Andy. For one thing, we were talking about this before we began recording. When I remember you in the 30s and early 40s, there wasn't the prosperity there was today. And in fact, matter of fact, a lot of people didn't even have radios. We happened to be lucky enough to have one in the 30s during the Depression. And I can remember the lady from across the street, it was a Mrs. Hemmerling, who was a friend of my grandmother's, who used to come across every day.
Yeah.
And walk across our street just to hear Amos and Andy, because it was a real treat for those people.
Yeah, well, I remember there were lots of crystal sets even when we first started in radio. And a lot of people didn't have radio sets. And they would go places to listen not only to us, but to other radio shows, too. Like you said, in the department stores, lots of stores would turn their radio sets on, and people would gather out in front and listen to not only ours, but other ones, too. And it was we started on the network right in the middle of the Depression, you know. We started on the network in 1929. When you get any more of the Depression than that was, I don't know where you're going to get it.
Well, I think if I say goodbye to you, instead of playing my usual theme, which I do, I think I'll play your theme.
What's that?
With the perfect song.
Oh, the perfect song,
yeah.
Yes.
I've got a recording of that. We'll just put this behind this interview.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful tune. I'll never forget it, and as long as ever I live.
Well, I don't think most people who were around in the 30s and 40s and 50s remember that.
Well, it was
people
picked,
forget it.
It was picked by the president of the Pepsodent Company at that time, and we thought it was crazy. We thought we ought to have something like some blues or something, you know, some blues song and all. But the more we listened to it, the more we thought, no, this, you don't get tired of this, and it's a very beautiful thing, so we kept it, and it has always followed us around. Every time I go into the restroom tonight, any place, if there's a piano player or an orchestra, they'll play it.
Yeah, it's very well remembered.
Yep.
I've been chatting today with Mr. Charles Correll, alias Andy Brown, from Amos and Andy for so many years on radio and inspired the TV version of the same title. And I'd like to thank him very much. Until next week, the same time, this is Richard Van Karski in Beverly Hills. Good night.